You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
And welcome into a early Sunday afternoon edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. New Year's Eve, fun fact of the day. Today is the only day in human history everyone born in the 1900s is currently an adult or perhaps dead. Everyone born in the 2000s is still a minor, but that changes tomorrow because if you're born on January 1st, 2000, you will be turning 18, and that will continue indefinitely. All right, I'm joined by Josh Bass. You are listening to the Locked On Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. I'm your host, all-around Nets expert Gavin Shaw, at Gavin Shaw on Twitter. And as I mentioned in this convoluted intro, I'm joined by Josh Bass, JM underscore Bass. Am I getting that right? I never know your Twitter handle.
JM Bass underscore, I think. I don't really know it either.
Okay, good. Okay, I like that. I think people should have to find it.
Just aside, would you want to have your birthday on like a New Year's or Christmas? Because I think it's kind of a weird.
Yeah. No, I don't like the idea of like, I don't know. It's kind of exciting because like everyone gets to celebrate, but could you, and like, on one hand, like I feel like it's kind of prime birthday time when you're growing up because everyone's off for winter break, so you can throw a big party. But also, so many people are away. Like I feel like there'd be like a bunch of it's possible like your best friend would never go to your birthday party because every year he'd be like, oh, I'm going to visit my cousins in Colorado, like year in and year out. So that's kind of a danger. But I was thinking like, wouldn't it have been kind of cool? Like I'm actually like pretty content with when I was born. Like sometimes I think it would have been cool to have been born in the early 80s, so you got more kind of like of the relatively peaceful time of the 90s versus the 2010s that I think have kind of sucked. But I wouldn't it have been kind of cool to have been born like a day before 2000 or January 1st, 2000. Like I just feel like that would feel like kind of like a special day to be born.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I think it's so hard to kind of compare that because you don't know the feeling.
Yeah.
But
I think about that stuff a lot. Like when was like the best time to be born? It's like I feel like
then you'd be overshadowed. Your birthday would be overshadowed by the millennium.
Yeah. But it's also like so cool. It's like that's once every 1,000 years. You're just born on that day.
You kind of like remember it.
No, I know, but you're kind of like a special baby. But what was I gonna say? Yeah, no, I do. I do think about that stuff a lot because I feel like you and I were both born in. You were born in 1995, as far as I know, unless it's like a Manute Bol situation and you're actually in your early 40s.
Shabazz Muhammad.
Which I haven't ruled out quite yet, but I'll say this, like I wouldn't mind it being born a little bit earlier. I'm happy we weren't born later because I feel like even the people born like 3-4 years after us like never grew up without like there was no portion of their childhood that didn't involve like a cell phone or a computer. And like obviously like I know like I brought that up to people who were older and they were like, well, we were just like watching TV all the time, so maybe it's not that different. But I like that, even though maybe it hasn't really helped us because I think we're both pretty phone obsessed people, and like as most people our age are, but I think it did give us like a little bit of a degree of separation and like knowing what life was like without those things versus like people born in like 99 and on were just like from like the time they were 10, they probably were constantly on a phone.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I think that I'm very happy that we had some time without technology and we're able to kind of remember the good old days a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm so interested. Like, if I ever have kids or like any of my friends do, like what their policy with phones are going to be. Because like in like an ideal world, I would be like, okay, I'm not going to give them like an iPad or like a cell phone until they're like 10, 11, 12. But then you think of like the safety stuff and like even beyond that, like I feel like when you see like parents with like crying kids and like the need to like constantly entertain them, and then you think about like you could just throw them an iPad and they're set for 4 hours. Like I don't think I'm gonna actually be strong enough to resist that temptation, even though like from an ideals perspective, I think I would.
Yeah, no, we really covered some existential topics there.
This is good. Right, do we still want to talk about the Nets, or do you think that's a podcast?
I mean, I don't think anyone's listening at this point.
Okay, good. All right, so let's just for fun, indulge me. Let's talk about the Nets. You could argue their best. I would say right after that Wizards game, maybe their second best win over the year over the Miami Heat. They were down early 8-0 and then 18-8, went on to win 111-87, and it was even worse than that at points. They were up by, I think, close to 40. There was a stretch, Josh, and I was like mapping this out as the game went, where they outscored the Miami Heat, a team that's won 7 of their last 9 games, 60-23 over a stretch. That's pretty insane.
Oh, it's crazy. They were up by 20 at the half, and I thought, okay, you know, this is the Nets we're talking about. We saw that game against the Pacers maybe a week or two ago when they were up by 16 at the half and ended up losing in overtime. I'm like, no lead is safe with this team. We all know their third quarter troubles, but then they came out in the third quarter and outscored them by 15. And then after that, I was able to have dinner with my parents and not have to look over at the TV. During the fourth quarter, I was able to kind of relax, which is not something that this Nets team usually allows me to do. So props to them, and they really helped me out a lot.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. And there were a bunch of guys who just played. It wasn't even that many guys who shot well. It was really just Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, 8 of 9 from the field. Joe Harris, a career high, 21 points, 7 rebounds, 7 of 9, 4 of 4 from behind the arc. And then everyone else was just kind of solid. It was almost more so on the defensive end where they just like really flummoxed the Heat. Miami finished the game shooting just 34% from the field. Even worse, they were 3 for 26 from three-point range. So a lot of that was on Miami. Clearly they were off, but the Nets were just so smart defensively in this game, and obviously it helps. I mean, I know Hassan Whiteside was good and he was effective this game, but it helps to not be going against Anthony Davis and Boogie Cousins. But they were just so smart on defense, and it seemed like every single possession there weren't really those breakdowns that you've grown kind of accustomed to seeing out of this Nets team.
Yeah, I think, well, as far as the shooting numbers go for the Nets side, fourth quarter kind of diluted a lot of that because only scored 16 points in that quarter. Caris LeVert and Jared Allen, their final numbers may not look that stellar from the field, but they were incredible in the first three quarters. As far as defense goes, I think the first quarter, I'd say the Heat were missing a lot of easy shots. Wayne Ellington in particular couldn't make it, Wayne. But then I think the second, third quarters, that's when the Nets defense really picked up, and they were just kind of stifling the Heat. And Hassan Whiteside was getting his, as you mentioned, because he was 5 inches taller than anyone who was guarding him, whether it was Rondae Hollis-Jefferson or Quincy Acey. He just dwarfed them, and he was able to just shoot right over them. But as a whole, the Nets were really competing, and it's great to see that kind of energy, especially after the Pelicans game when they really got embarrassed.
Yeah, let's devote some time to those two Nets who really did play well. Joe Harris, we just mentioned it, the career high, 21 points. I know he went 4-4 from behind the arc, and like that to me was like almost expected to some degree, because he's been shooting so poorly relative to how he did earlier in the season. Like the first month or so of the year, I remember him hovering right around 40%. Here, I have his splits up right now. Yeah, he was shooting 42% from three in October, 37% in November in this past month, all the way down to 34%. So he was kind of due for a game where he just really shot the lights out of the basketball. But the thing with him that I continue to remain most impressed by is his ability to get to the rim. And again, he doesn't like you don't think of him as this explosive guy, but he is strong, and he's just like he's a good linear driver. And so many times guys in the league will try and like stop, do hesitations, crossover, start and stop, and he's just good at just putting his head down, getting his hip into you, creating separation, and then just a strong touch around the basket. With a lot of times pure shooters, that doesn't necessarily carry over to around the rim, but with Harris it really is consistent. So that's something that surprised me this season and has been such an essential part of his game, and I'm interested to see how it keeps growing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something about his drive that really, he does a good job. I mean, obviously, if he's in an ISO situation, he's not going to do anything, but if he catches the ball on the move, has a step, he's able to, as you mentioned, create separation. He has some good finishes, some really creative ones around the basket, and for his archetype of a player, that's not to be expected. But
white guy.
Exactly. I'm a white guy. Honestly, just, he's really impressed me this year, and I'm not like a huge fan of his three-point shooting. I think it's like a little overblown. It's definitely, Allen Crabbe is a better pure shooter, even though this year Crabbe has kind of been trash compared to what we expected. But Harris, just he always seems to be in the right spot. Defensively, he competes. He's been used as a stopper in some situations for the Nets, and even though he's not going to be able to live up to that at all, he does a good job of never giving up on plays, and his effort's always there. I think he could be someone that I'd like to see on the Nets team in the coming years. Obviously, maybe not in the role that he is now, but definitely a decent bench piece that can fill in for key minutes when needed.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I know we've talked about him as a potential trading chip at points. I'd like to see him on the Nets for the next 10 years if possible. I think he's a guy that every team needs, and he's so comfortable in Brooklyn and confident in what he's doing. I'd hate to see him go somewhere else.
10 years? Are you kidding me?
What? I mean, until he's like 30. Okay, maybe not 10. I mean, a lot of guys don't last till 30. That was an exaggeration. But like until he's like
Give me five.
All right, five.
Yeah, he's a shooter. He's probably going to age well, but yeah. Yeah, 30. Yeah, he probably won't be in the NBA when he's 36. But five years of peak Joe Harris, I think that could be beneficial to the Nets. I want to throw this out there because I mentioned it a couple times in the last podcast, but now I've noticed it. It's like kind of a trend. You mentioned it with Harris defensively. I think he brings that. And I'm probably shortchanging the starters a little bit just because I don't necessarily always watch them as closely on defense. But I want to give a shout out to Quincy Acey, a guy we've attacked a lot offensively. Like every single game I see him getting in position to take a charge. And his help defense, I think, has been as good or better than anyone else on this team. He just seems like he's always there to kind of save someone, and that really went away in the Pelicans game from a team perspective, but I think it's something the Nets have like steadily been improving on as the season goes along, like everyone helping everyone, and you can argue sometimes they overdo it and they give up open threes, but the last couple of games, even though they haven't really been winning, I think they've been really good in that area and really smart with helping, and I think Quincy Acey is kind of the leader of that trend.
Yeah, and he does take a lot of charges, now that I think about it. I feel like he always sets up in the lane like way too early, and then the guy just kind of runs into him, and as a fan, I can see it coming a mile away as he's just in position waiting as the guy starts his drive from like the 3-point.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like he does, like sometimes he goes too early because he's just like not fast enough.
Yeah, he's so excited at the possibility of taking a charge because it's like his highlight defensive play because he's not explosive enough to get any like blocks or big steals or anything like that. But taking a charge is his Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's true. But I feel like generally he's pretty smart about that. Josh, you might have seen it in the rundown, so just tell me because I don't want to cheat the listeners. But what percentage would you guess AC is shooting less than 10 feet away from the hoop this year?
What's his percentage on those shots, or how often?
What's his percentage on those shots? Less than 10 feet away from the hoop.
40%.
33. He's 8 for 23, so maybe he's a little bit higher than maybe 34, 35. But
Well, he has a little bit of Reggie Evans syndrome that when he does get an offensive rebound close to the hoop, he just tries to throw it back up and just like not look, no matter who's on him, he could have three guys draped all over him and three open shooters right in his vision on the perimeter. He'll still throw it up at the basket. So
he's
smart with those attempts.
It's that, and my even bigger issue with him is again, like if he gets the ball in the perimeter and a defender can run him off the line, like I feel like the defense has already won the possession. Like in all likelihood, it's going to result in a badly missed layup or a turnover. Like the odds of anything else happening are extremely low. All right, we are going to continue recapping this Heat game. Josh and I want to give you some thoughts on Caris LeVert and his position going forward because, as we all know, he's been playing a lot of point guard and playing it really well of late. And then we'll give you some quick thoughts on that Boston Celtics game coming up later today. Even though by the time most of you listen to it, the Nets will have probably already lost. All right, Josh, we are back into it. Any issues with me assuming the Nets will fall to the Celtics today, or are you with me?
No, I mean, I have to be with you. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that anything else. I mean,
no,
the Nets have played Boston close a few times. They never really get over the hump. And Boston's just like such a smart team, and I think they're the type of ball movement they have can really take advantage of the Nets, who have a lot of players that don't have the greatest basketball IQ, especially on the defensive end. So I think that Boston should win this pretty comfortably. But listen, maybe they'll start, they'll end 2017 on a high note for me, and I'll be very happy going into the new year if they can surprise us.
Yeah, it'd be awesome if they could pull it off. All right, a couple more quick thoughts on this Heat game before we really get into Boston. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, I can't remember who was talking about during the game, but it really is amazing. I mean, like for a guy who all of his offense comes 16 feet and in, I think he has just about like the most diverse offensive game for someone with that qualifier on it. Like he's scoring so many different ways, and they were talking about like running the floor in transition, beating guys off the dribble and finishing at weird angles or getting fouled. And then like the jump shot game has just been like I know we've talked about it a lot this year, but like the last couple of games, like I've seen him like hit a bunch of really tough like turnarounds and fadeaways, and it just seems like he has so much confidence in the shots. And like, and I'm at the point now where I feel like anytime he shoots from that range, it feels like it's going in.
Yeah, I think that his development as a tough shot maker in that mid range has been so unexpected. I think that the Nets could honestly go to that even more, especially in late game situations, because he is so reliable at that. And I think that when their offense bogs down, he can be a crucial part of kind of getting it started again, because he really is the best pure shot maker on this team now that D'Angelo Russell is injured, because he is such a mid-range assassin right now, and he can just knock that shot down with confidence, no matter if he's being guarded by a guy who might have a huge wingspan and can really get up and contest. He's just, his mechanics are so fluid in that aspect.
Yeah, and you said it, despite like often being guarded by bigger guys this season, or maybe you could argue that's to his advantage, he is shooting 50% from the field, still not a great three-point shooter at 35%, but that's picked up in December. He's still only taking 1 3 a game, but that's the most he's taken in any month this season, and he's hitting 0.4 a game. So again, not really a substantial sample size, but he is shooting.
I like a three-point shot when he's wide open.
It's been better.
It doesn't look good, obviously, but something about it is very nostalgic. I think it's like his three-point shot, the way he gets like really pushed to make it get to the basket, it reminds me of like a little kid's form.
Yeah. I agree with that. It's like how Steph Curry shot in college before he switched up his shot a little bit.
But listen, RHA has been making it when he's wide open. I think that's obviously he's never going to be a great three-point shooter. He needs to be respected beyond the arc, and one big part of that is making shots when you're completely wide open.
Yeah, and he is, and again, 42% for the month of December. So I expect that would go way, way down if he was shooting more than one a game. But again, when he's wide open, he has been hitting them at a fair rate. All right, last couple thoughts on the Heat game. One thing I really liked is I thought Alan Crabb's passing was really, really good in this game. And he actually only finished with one assist, but there were like three or four different plays where guys like fumbled his passes and could have had layups, or like he'd get a hockey assist. But he's just been making really smart plays of late. And I know he was only 2 of 8 this game. You don't pay a guy $70 million to go 2 of 8 and be like a ball mover. But he's been playing really smart basketball over the last few games. And we talked about how like just a bunch early in the season, how like when he's off, like he would single-handedly tank the Nets. And like when he's on, obviously he's a game changer. But now even when he's not shooting well, I like when he's on the court. I feel like he's making positive contributions. And again, I know that's not necessarily living up to his contract, and you could still make a very compelling argument that was a bad trade for the Nets. But I'm happy with his progress as a player. And I think like when the shooting comes, it's going to look really, really good with his kind of improved four sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Crab fan.
I know you're not.
Yeah, be that pretty clear. I don't know. One of the passes that he had where Damari Carroll fumbled it out of bounds, he was like 10 feet away from him and fired it 100 miles an hour bounce pass that like Carroll mishandled. But also, you need to have a little softer touch on that pass, Alan Crab.
No, you got to put some sauce on it.
Sauce Castillo. His defense, Crab's defense, has been, I think, a little bit better lately. He's getting some deflections, has pretty good hands. I think that's been an improvement from the start of the year where he was kind of lost out there and kind of like a little kid in Little League in the outfield, just like practicing waiting for offense and practicing a swing.
Oh, that was me.
That was you?
I was like the kid who had like the butterfly in my glove.
One of those.
That guy, yeah, Yogue.
But yeah, I think Krabs, I don't know, I'm just not a big fan of this guy. I think that his shooting definitely needs to pick up, because right now he's having wide open looks and just can't hit anything. And then when you complement that with the difficult attempts he takes, that his percentage is really going to plummet. And at 36% right now, considering he's not a good, not efficient from 2-point range, it's making for a pretty bad offensive player.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. He has to turn it around in a big way in terms of shooting the ball. But some of the peripheral stuff I kind of like. And again, I think when that shot does come around, I think we're going to see someone who's generally makes a positive impact for this Nets team. But we'll have to find out. All right, that's about all I had on this Heat game. The Nets bench, a big time shout out to them. Like a game after the Pellies where I think the bench had something like 80 points, and it was like the fourth highest bench effort for the Nets in team history. They scored the first 19 bench points of this game. So that was pretty good, pretty compelling, and that continues to be an advantage for the Nets. And again, like I don't necessarily think it's the talent on the Nets bench. Like while like LeVert and Harris are like clearly like I don't want to say too good to be on the bench, because Harris would be a bench guy for most teams, but like are both like very solid bench players, and Allen is untalented enough that he's like probably too good to be on the bench, at least like over the next couple of years. Like I give most of the credit to Kenny Atkinson and his staff for kind of empowering them in a way other coaches don't. And big time shout out to them as we kind of wrap up this year for how they played throughout the season.
Yeah, and I also want to give props to Atkinson, because after Russell and Jeremy Lin went down, He could have said, listen, we're going to call up Isaiah Whitehead. He's going to be our backup point guard from now on. But he saw enough in LeVert to say, listen, we're going to let this guy handle the ball for the second unit and really empower him to make plays. He's done an excellent job in being the point guard for the backup unit.
Yeah, and that's something we kind of wanted to get into. And Josh, if you could do a little bit of a deeper dive on that, what are kind of your thoughts on his position going forward? Because I don't really see him as like ever being like a starting point guard, just because I don't know. And maybe I've kind of gotten spoiled by watching Dinwiddie so much, and LeVert brings a lot that Dinwiddie doesn't, like that explosiveness. Like Dinwiddie's never quite going to be in the same category as him. But at the same time, like watching Dinwiddie and someone who's just so clearly like born to play the position and is such a floor general and is so smart in everything he does. And I'm not saying LeVert isn't that. And like he's coming off a game where he had a career high 11 assists and he's still really young. So maybe he'll get there. But I don't know. I just don't get the sense that he's a full-time point guard. And I think it's a little bit different being a starting point guard in this league than just kind of being the guy who controls the ball with backups. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that it's tough because for me, when I watch LeVert play backup point guard, he can make a lot of plays, but at the same time, most of the offense, just him kind of using screen and roll, and he's not really spotting up and letting other guys run plays. And also that could be part of the reason why it comes down to that the Nets don't have a lot of playmakers in that second unit. They have guys that can spot up like Joe Harris and Stauskas and Quincy Acey, but LeVert needs to create all the plays for that. So I'm not sure if he was surrounded by more offensive talent, how that would kind of how that would work out. But I think that I see him as kind of like an Ginobili type role. Obviously, I don't think he's going to have the career of Ginobili because he's the guy of the Hall of Famer. But in that role where he's handling the ball most of the time, but he's not really the nominal point guard, but he can obviously play with the starters, play with the bench unit, and he's finishing games. I don't know if you think that comparison is apt or not, but that's kind of how I see LeVert flourishing with the Nets.
No, I think that's an excellent comparison. Like I couldn't really put my finger on what the equivalent was and like what the proven track record of a guy like that succeeding is. And I think you absolutely nailed it. Like someone obviously, Manu Ginobili is a Hall of Famer, one of the four or so greatest international players of all time. So you don't want to put him in the same breath as him. But someone in that mold, I think that's perfect. And obviously, like by the time he's like 26, 27, 28, he's going to be, I think, like a good starter in this league in terms of talent level, but maybe someone that the Nets kind of using that Spurs model, like keep playing off the bench and then like let him finish games with someone like Spencer Dinwiddie or someone like D'Angelo Russell, whoever is the point guard 4 or 5 years down the road for the Nets. I could see kind of a structure like that being really, really successful. And then maybe you just play him next to a nominal point guard that's just a really good shooter and defender, like kind of like the Patrick Beverley to James
like a
Harden.
Pat Mills, it does for the Spurs.
Yeah, exactly. Someone like that I think would be kind of the perfect complement to that. Like because the big thing with LeVert is his ability to get into the lane, draw defenders, and kick it out. And like having someone who could just spot up around that at the point guard spot who doesn't really need to dominate the ball just feels kind of like the perfect complement because I'm interested to see this. Like we both have no concrete knowledge on this, but you kind of get the feeling based on what people are saying, D'Angelo Russell's maybe going to be back sometime in January, if not early February. And like, again, we could be completely off on that. This is mostly speculation, but you really wonder if Caris LeVert is going to take a step back when that happens, just given how poorly he played when Russell was healthy compared to how he's been playing recently. And it's going to be kind of interesting how they juggle that.
Well, I still think that once D'Lo comes back, and I really hope it's going to be by the end of January. If not, I'll be pretty disappointed. Russell's being way conservative with his timetable. But I think that Dinwiddie and Russell would play well together. They can play off each other. Dinwiddie's very good at spotting up. He's a good defender. I think let LeVert keep doing what he's doing in the backup point guard, and also he'll get some playing time with Spencer Dinwiddie. But I think that three-guard rotation would really work out nicely.
No, I'm with you, but I mean, do you think like I think at some point like everyone's gonna have to take a step back in minutes unless you just want to cut someone else out of the rotation.
I think Stauskas will probably be
that's a guy.
He's gonna be out of the rotation. Harris, his minutes will take a deep dive. Alan Crabb, he doesn't really need to be playing 34 minutes on my television screen. But they'll make it work. I mean,
yeah,
also, I guarantee when Russell comes back, someone else is gonna get injured and everything will be blown up because the Nets can never have anything nice.
That's true. Yeah. I think logically like Stauskas is probably the guy who drops out, even though again, I continue to not totally mind how he's been playing. All right, I wanted to take a minute. I know we do it every single podcast, but it always helps. Please keep rating and reviewing the Locked On Nets podcast if you're listening in your iTunes app or on Stitcher or wherever you get the Locked On Nets podcast. It is super easy. You just go on your phone. There will be an obvious area to rate and review the podcast. Give us 5 stars. Give us 4. Want to give less than that? Maybe just skip it. Just kind of have fun on your New Year's Eve. Anyways, we really appreciate it. And as we kind of wind down the year, big time shout out to anyone who's continued to listen to the Locked On Nets podcast. We know it's been choppy in terms of when we can release them at times. And Josh and I have both kind of been finding our footing as full-time podcast hosts because it is a big adjustment. And especially you, Josh, like I wanted to give you a shout out for, and I know we're not really done with the podcast yet. So I don't really want to go too deep on this, but like for being so consistent with this, and I think really turning into an excellent co-host. And so thank you to our fans. Thank you to Josh. I wanted to get that in before the end of the pod.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, no, I know. I had to go there. All right. So quick thoughts on the Celtics game. Yeah, I kind of agree with what you said earlier. Like in terms of like the energy, tenaciousness they play with, how well coached they are, they kind of do remind me of the Nets in some ways, but just a way more evolved version. And like clearly for like how brilliant Atkinson is on defense, I think it makes as an offensive coach, I think it makes you respect Brad Stevens even more for the type of defense he's gotten. I think the Celtics are the 4th youngest team in the NBA, or maybe the 5th youngest team in the NBA, and they're the best or 2nd best defense in all basketball. So that just kind of shows you how far ahead of the curve they are. And obviously the other big separating factor is the Celtics have Kyrie Irving in the Nets, though.
Yeah, Kyrie Irving, Al Horford, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum.
Yeah, okay, this is one of us.
I think, yeah, it's going to be a tough matchup for the Nets, especially I think that kind of stylistically they're pretty similar. I think the Nets have had a lot of trouble this year with the stretch bigs. We can go back to Vucevic the first couple of games of the season where he was just torching the Nets, and Horford can do the same type of thing, especially if he's on from 3. I think that it's going to be interesting to see who gets the primary assignment on Kyrie Irving. I'm assuming that's going to be Spencer Dinwiddie, and I think his length can give him some trouble. But at the same time, the Nets do have to kind of worry about rebounding because Horford and Baynes playing together can be an interesting tandem, and I think the Nets have had trouble with 2 bigs this year, going back to the games against the Knicks and the Pelicans. So Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and Tyler Zeller need to have a lot of energy and be on point to make sure that the Nets aren't getting killed on the offensive glass.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't know. I feel a little bit more confident if this game was in Brooklyn just because before last night it had been so long since the Nets have won a road game. But I don't know. I kind of have the feeling like this is one that, like, if the Nets don't win, they can really take it down to the wire. Like the Celtics, if you listen to like any Bill Simmons podcast on any subject, he'll inevitably mention how tough their schedule has been recently. And like they have legitimately been playing like a ton of games in a relatively few amount of days, given how much the NBA has tried to spread it out this year. Well, I think the Nets should be relatively well rested from that Heat game. They get to play relatively close to home in Boston. I don't know. This just feels like the type of game where like the Nets could either pull an upset or maybe like kind of like those last 2 Cavs and Warriors game where they'll keep it close till the final minutes and then the Celtics will pull away. I'd expect a really good effort from Brooklyn today. All right, so that just about does it on my end. Josh, any final thoughts?
No, I think, again, guys, I really, really appreciate you being loyal listeners of this podcast. As Gavin mentioned, we've kind of figured some things out along the way, and I think that 2018 is going to be a huge year for us. And Gavin, you gave me the shout-out before. I want to give back to you. You've been a great host this entire time and really keeping us on point besides the intro to today's episode where we talked about the holiday birthdays. But
it's
been a pleasure to work with, and I think that I'm excited to keep it going in 2018.
All right, awesome. Okay, so you heard it from Josh. You heard it from me. We really appreciate what you guys have been doing, and we will continue with the podcast over the next 2 weeks. Probably come back with a Celtics recap early next week, so be on the lookout for that. For Josh, I'm Gavin. Happy New Year's. Peace out.